I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Mike Pesca is the host of The Gist, a popular podcast on Slate, and he's the editor of a new book in which writers envision sports scenarios that didn't actually happen, and then they speculate on what the consequences might have been. Sports writers, political analysts, columnists, an NPR host, an actor, a filmmaker, and others indulge in flights of fancy and imagine what the world might be like if certain games had turned out differently, if certain decisions had gone the other way, or if things we never imagined had been imagined. The book is called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Mike Pesca joins me for a confection of counterfactualization when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Thanks for being with us today. A conversation about sports. Not the World Cup, certainly not the Orioles, God help us, not the Ravens, who start training camp a week from Thursday, but instead we're going to talk about a simple question that, when applied to certain moments and historical realities in sports, can lead to some delicious fantasizing. That question is, what if? To wit, what if Billie Jean King had lost to Bobby Riggs? What if Richard Nixon had been good at football? What if the Olympics had never dropped tug of war? What if Muhammad Ali had gotten his draft deferment? Mike Pesca has assembled a group of essayists to pose those and other questions in a great and engaging and funny and sometimes profound book called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Mike Pesca is the host of The Gist, a podcast on Slate.com. He's a former sports reporter at NPR. He does sports analysis for Here and Now. He's been a guest host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he's the kind of guy who inspires one to ask, what if Mike Pesca were an Olympic gold medalist in the luge? If that were true, he would not be my guest today. He'd be at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a mall in Paramus, New Jersey. But alas, it isn't true. Mike's gold medal in the luge is something we can only dream about. Although I'll admit, if I'm going to spend my time dreaming, Mike, I'm not dreaming about you in the luge. You are, in fact, not in Paramus. You are in Brooklyn. Welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
I'm in Brooklyn, the Paramus of just east of Manhattan. Me in the luge is one thing. Me in that luge unitard, that's a whole nother thing.
Exactly. Another reason to dream elsewhere. Exactly. The premise of this book is terrific, and the book itself is a great, great read, so congratulations on it. But the whole notion of what if, how did you come to that? That's explain to folks what the sort of the conceit of the book is.
So I, as you said, I was an NPR sports correspondent for 7 years. And in that time, I went to, I think, 6 World Series, 7 Super Bowls, World Cup, Olympics, and the Final Fours. And there'd always be a champion and confetti or sometimes a gold medal, but often confetti. And when the confetti rained down one day, it got my eyes a little bit. And I said to myself, you know, here I am as a Knicks fan and a Jets fan and a Mets fan. And I have cumulatively in my cognizant life seen one championship, and I got to some reverie and I started saying, well, what if the teams had made some different decisions? But then I said to myself, you know, that is fine for fans to fuel themselves and believe in the next season. But I wanted to apply some rules and some structure to the what if, because every fan says what if, and what they're really saying is if only this call had gone our way or the draft pick had worked out better. So I started developing these rules and contacting these essayists or potential essayists to write essays that were a little more structured and a little more pointed than if only your favorite team had a couple breaks. And what resulted was the 31 essays and foreword by Malcolm Gladwell there in the book.
And in the foreword that Malcolm Gladwell wrote and in the introduction that you wrote that follows it, Malcolm Gladwell does a what if about, of all things, the slave trade and what would have happened had the slave trade been structured somewhat differently and how it might have affected American sports, of all things. And you talk about, you know, one of the great what ifs in history being August of 1776, when Washington was near exactly where you are today, Brooklyn, New York, in a really thick fog, and how that helped him eventually overcome pretty strong odds and turn the tide of the American Revolution. So, I mean, it really is fun once you set up that premise to think about what might have happened, but you can think of it in pretty broad terms.
Yeah, you could get very profound and very serious. So I would say that my Washington example sets the tone in saying that everything we know about U.S. history was somewhat dependent on the fog. Historians do agree that that was a seminal battle, the Battle of Brooklyn. And without the fog as cover, Washington doesn't escape. And the U.S. experiment or the American experiment is at least halted, if not denied. So but for a small factor. And what Gladwell is doing in his book is he's saying that the type of athletes that we get from West Africa with a slave trade was centered versus the type of athletes that we'd get from East Africa probably had an influence on what kind of sports we participate in and like and who's good at what sports. And it is something really deep to think about. And then on the far other side of that continuum, we have an essay by John Boyce. What if the basketball rims were smaller than the basketballs?
And you exactly. might. And it's terrific.
Second, yeah. You might for a second pause and say, well, wouldn't the basketballs not go in? Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
In his essay.
And there's an entire play-by-play imagination about what would happen.
And Reggie Miller doesn't really change that much from a game where you can score to a game where you can't. He's still pretty didactic.
Now, how did you pick the writers? Because there are some really, really great prose in here and some really, really interesting picks, like Robert Siegel. And his essay is terrific. It's a what-if of a what-if. Because it's called What If the Dodgers Had Left Brooklyn? And of course,
right.
The Dodgers did leave Brooklyn. So how did you get Robert Siegel to write about that?
Right. Editor's note, we know the Dodgers did leave Brooklyn. But, you know, let's say the Dodgers hadn't and they were still in Brooklyn. And let's say someone came along and decided to write a book of what ifs. I'm sure one of those chapters would be, hey, you ever wonder what if the Dodgers left Brooklyn? So just a funny way to get to it. And the great thing about that is there is a podcast called Upon Further Review where we took five chapters and did them in different ways in audio form. And Robert Siegel, it marks his return to the airwaves, or at least the pod waves, where he is essentially hosting a very NPR-esque show, a public radio show, where he talks about it being 2018 and the Dodgers just leaving Brooklyn. It was a joy to take Robert Siegel's illustrious career and have him ruin it for a larf on our podcast.
And he does refer to the L.A. Dodgers as an hypothetical monstrosity in that,
yeah.
In that
yeah.
Thought. You also have Steve Karnacki from MSNBC, who writes about Tom Brady and Drew Bledsoe and what led to Brady becoming the ascendant quarterback with New England and Bill Belichick. I mean, how did you decide to get a political analyst for MSNBC to write about football?
Right. So to go back to your question, which was how did you cast the book, essentially? How did you get the 31 writers assembled? Some I just went to because I knew they either were sports writers or like sports, and I thought I had an inkling that they'd come up with something. And Karnacki is in that category. I'm on his show a lot, or was on his show when he had a Sunday show, and we do things on MSNBC together. And I know that he loves sports and New England sports and, strangely, Kansas State football. And I pitched him on the idea, and he loved it, and he got back to me. And this was a really good chapter to have because I do think that it is quite possible if the world were to rewind and play itself out 1,000 times. I think about 300 of those times, we'd never know the name Tom Brady. But for an injury to quarterback Drew Bledsoe, he wouldn't have taken over. He was, you know, the 199th pick in the draft. And there was a lot of happenstance and luck or bad luck for everyone else in the NFC East that he took over. So that's one answer. So for about 20 of these essays, I just hit up some people I thought would be interesting and waited to see what ideas they had. And then for the rest of them, I sort of backfilled and say, okay, what's our mix of sports? What's our mix of sports eras? What's our mix of tone? And I said, all right, I think I need a more bread and butter one about football. And I got Michael McCambridge to write, what if the Baltimore Colts had won Super Bowl III, which is a great essay.
Yeah, something that people in Baltimore think a lot about.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, your audience might know this, but to a national audience, I think he really does make the case that there is no Miami Dolphins perfect season because Don Shula never leaves the Colts, and the Colts probably don't leave Baltimore. So I think that's plausible.
Yeah, absolutely plausible. You know, and you know, when you talk about people filling in for an indisposed person, you know, Bledsoe getting hurt, it gives Brady his chance. I mean, this happens in all sorts of iterations. And Leonard Bernstein wouldn't have conducted the New York Philharmonic as a young man had the regular conductor not gotten sick. I mean, now he was a genius. He may have, you know, he probably would have been discovered in some way along the line, but he had his moment then, and it is even larger than sports in a lot of ways. The best title in the book, in my humble estimation, is called "What If a Blimp Full of Money Had Exploded Over World Track Headquarters in 1952?" I have to confess, I had never thought about what if a blimp full of money had exploded over World Track headquarters in 1952. This was revelatory to me.
Yeah, this is I would say, the ne plus ultra of dirigible-based hypothetical sports journalism. And it's an interesting chapter. I didn't know I was that into track, but so many people pitched me track chapters, or I went and solicited these great track writers to write, you know, what if Roger Bannister had trained with modern gear, or that blimp chapter. And just the whole idea of taking the world of sports and reorienting it away from football, basketball, baseball, towards track, which is extremely popular in Europe. And there are, but for a few reasons, track and field could have been the dominant sport. And so we play out a history. We change one element, which is what if there was really a lot of money in track? And we kind of invent that ghost in the machine to make that possible. Okay, so but for that one change, one wrinkle, what happens? And what happens is, some of the great rivalries, like Wilt Chamberlain against Bill Russell, don't take place on the hardwood. They take place in the high jump, because both those guys are great high jumpers, and on and on.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a terrific, terrific premise. You, and I would say, by the way, my second favorite title is "What If Basketball Rims Were Smaller Than Basketballs?" And and just the play-by-play of that really is quite extraordinary, where, you know, someone gets charged with goaltending, and the announcer says, you know, hey, he doesn't need to goaltend. The ball can't go in. It's just, it really is terrific. There is also some really, when you talk about the differences in tone between one essay to the next, there is some really terrific writing. I mean, I don't want to single too many people out, because it's great across the board. But a woman named Katie Baker writes about Wayne Gretzky, and I just found her writing to be so powerful.
Yeah, she's the best. I think she's the best hockey writer, or long-form hockey writer. She writes for The Ringer and wrote for Grantland. And that was an example where I said, okay, I need a hockey chapter. This is a chance to hit up Katie Baker, and then maybe I'll go down on the list if she can't do it. And she said yes, and it was gold. It was Gretzky gold. By the way, he could have been a New Jersey Devil. Oh, my God.
Yeah, just imagine. Because she reminds me, or tells me, because I'm sure if I knew, I'd forgotten, that Gretzky was actually never drafted in the NHL.
Right. He played for the other league, the ABA of hockey, played for the AHL, and then his rights were retained by the Edmonton Oilers, but it wasn't an actual draft process, and he very easily could have played for the Colorado Rockies, and the Rockies became the Devils, and then all of history changes.
Yeah, I mean, his contract was even interesting. It was a personal services contract between him and the person who owned the Edmonton Oilers. So it wasn't even like a normal contract. And he's 18 years old. He's obviously a gifted kid, but he's a kid. And so he was like almost like an indentured servant of the owner of the Edmonton Oilers. And then one thing led to another. And that's where he was. Yeah.
Yeah. He had to do yard work on the weekend to that guy's house.
But
it does raise a good point that these are ways to get history lessons. I mean, basketball rims, that's just fanciful and whimsical, and that's great. But the Gretzky chapter has a few changes to consider, but also you learn a lot along the way if you ever cared about Wayne Gretzky. Or the penultimate chapter in the book, Claude Johnson wrote about this history that I didn't know about, which is essentially the pre-integration professional basketball before the NBA even existed. And there was this jamboree of great teams, the barnstorming teams like the Harlem Wrens and the Harlem Globetrotters against the then Minneapolis Lakers and George Mikan. And but for a changed past, a pass, Claude Johnson points out that basketball probably would have been integrated 7 to 10 years earlier. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and that all hinged on a single play in a single game that wasn't the NBA. It was a bunch of teams of traveling black basketball players who couldn't play in the NBA. Fascinating stuff. Yep. We'll come back after a break and talk more about it. Mike Pesca is the force behind the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. More with Mike when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're tuned to Midday. Thanks very much for doing that. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies. Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post join me for an amiable chat about the latest in cinematic fare. We're also going to talk about the paucity of women in the field of film criticism. Ann, of course, a noted film critic for the Washington Post, and she is one of the few female film critics working today in major legacy journalism. Of the 100 top movies last year in 2017, 78% of them were reviewed by white men. So we're going to have a chat about that. Plus, J. Wynn Russick, another female critic, by the way, is going to review a selection of plays from this year's Contemporary American Theater Festival. That's happening right now in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. By the way, looking ahead to Friday, it's the Midday News Wrap. We're going to talk about Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Trump's trip to the NATO meeting, that got off to a heck of a start this morning, and his tete-a-tete with Vladimir Putin. That's coming up Midday Friday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Mike Pesca, the host of the podcast The Gist on Slate.com and the editor and compiler-in-chief of the new book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. If you've got a what-if you'd like to share, you are welcome to give us a call here. Our number on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org to send us a tweet @midday_WYPR. You want to follow me on Twitter? That's a swell idea, @TomHallWYPR. We have an email from a listener who says, is the book suitable for an 11-year-old? I would give it a hearty yes. How about you, Mike? What do you think?
Absolutely. I have an 11-year-old who's read most of it and likes most of it.
There you go. An unsolicited testimonial right there from the author of the book. Back to Malcolm Gladwell's introduction. He makes the point that counterfactual history, and by counterfactual we mean, you know, stuff that didn't happen. You think about it and then you riff from there. It is what real history is not, and that is a true test of the imagination. So this really is a great the premise, again, is a great springboard for figuring out all of the things that could be different. There was that movie, and I can't remember the name of it. I should have looked it up before I came into this studio, but I think Gwyneth Paltrow is in it.
Sliding Doors.
Sliding Doors. Where she gets on one subway, and her life turns out one way. She gets on another subway, and it turns out totally different. This is kind of the same thing. And sometimes the effects, the consequences on individual careers and on entire industries are huge.
Well, there are two. It's a little like Sliding Doors and it's a little like Man in the High Castle or one of those films where books where you take one event, change it, and then see the ripples. I think Sliding Doors, they just kind of, I'm somewhat familiar with the Paltrow oeuvre, but not entirely. But I think they play out different variations, how many different things could have happened by changing one event. Groundhog's Day is a little like that. So in the book, for the most part, let's change one thing and see what happens. But then there are some chapters when the one thing changes, then the other thing changes. And all of a sudden, you know, if Bucky Dent doesn't homer over the Green Monster in Stefan Fatsis's chapter, he plausibly lays out a scenario where the Red Sox win the World Series. They put the squeeze on the city of Boston and they shut down Fenway Park and open a big sports multiplex.
Yeah,
could happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. The reason I think these essays are so compelling is that the speculation about what might happen, or all the speculations, are very plausible, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really quite something. We had a tweet. This is one that you didn't cover specifically in the book, but Mike says, what if the USSR beat the USA and there was no miracle on ice in Olympic hockey? Care to speculate off the top of your head about the global, geopolitical implications of that having not happened?
Sure. That was one that I certainly considered because it's the greatest upset in sports history. At least we say so. I mean, Czechoslovakian people probably differ. But I was wondering what was the way in, because that's the way when the overwhelming favorite wins, how does it rewrite history? With the Baltimore Colts, you could sell me that they stay. With the USSR, are you going to tell me that the Soviet Empire lasts a few more years? There's probably some impact as far as the influx of Soviet players who eventually stocked NFL rosters. But what I did, and I did in fact have the inkling to pursue that chapter, and I reached out to Mike Arruzioni, and I wanted him to write a kind of first person
part of the
speculation.
Team, right.
Right. And it didn't come together. He was game, but this was late in the process. And I said to myself, well, we have a sequel. I'll tip my hand. I'm definitely going to pursue that Mike Arruzioni thing. But I think that would be interesting, how one individual's life might be changed. Jim Craig or Mike Arruzioni or Ken Morrow or one of the guys on that team.
Mike Pesca, the book is called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. There's also a podcast called Upon Further Review. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. You can find me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Sometimes your writers write about, you know, just sort of unlucky breaks. Right again, in the very beginning, Malcolm Gladwell writes about an imperfection on the green that changed the direction of the ball at a golf tournament in Turnberry. And is it Tom Watson? It wasn't his fault, but he ended up not winning that tournament and maybe not being counted among the greats in golf because of that. You know, it's a geographical glitch that he had no control over. There's a great chapter.
Geological,
on,
almost.
Yeah, geological. Exactly. Yeah. There's a great chapter on Muhammad Ali by great sports writer Lee Montville. And what would have happened to him and his career if he had not gone to prison for refusing to serve in the military during the Vietnam War? How we may know of Ali, how we may think of Ali. I mean, the fact that he had this highly publicized court case with the U.S. government really was formative in every way, not just to him personally, but to how we think of him.
Yeah. And I wanted an Ali chapter. I mean, there are a couple icons that I needed in there. I wanted an Ali chapter. Montville, who's one of the great writers, sports writers of all time, had written a book on this, and I pitched him, and he came up with this idea, and I was blown away, because how it really did play out, as we all know, is that Ali, as a member of the Nation of Islam, applies for conscientious objector status. He at first essentially gets it by the board that should be granting that, but then someone in the federal government, someone in the Justice Department, we still don't know who, intervenes and he's denied, which is odd because all others in his actually literally pacifist religion are allowed to pursue conscientious objector status. So because of his denial, he has this years-long fight with the boxing authorities and the U.S. government, and he actually does win at the Supreme Court, which is a very important decision, and in fact, one that President Trump apparently didn't know about a couple of weeks ago when he floated the idea of pardoning Ali, who doesn't need a pardon.
He doesn't need Supreme that. Court. Yeah.
Yeah. But what if, and this is the question, so what's the what if you want to do with Ali? You could do a what if about boxing, you could do a what if about activism, but this gets at both because it's early enough in his career where you ask if he doesn't have that obstacle, then what does Ali become? Ali was seen, I mean, now he's seen as a secular saint and, you know, the most revered sportsman in U.S. history. But then he was seen as a loudmouth. Then he was seen as someone who really popped off but didn't necessarily live by his convictions. And those 3 years in the wilderness, I think, are definitive proof that he walked the walk, because we all know that he could talk the talk. So it brandishes him as a legitimate conscientious objector and a legitimate spokesman for his religion and his cause. And he comes out the other end with tons of respect. And also, and this is interesting in terms of boxing, a different fighting style. He has to trade punches. And probably what happens is because beforehand he was a slippery fighter and so agile and could make people miss, but he was also so strong. You know, he gives up those 3 years of his youth. He has a slightly different fighting style and he's taking so many punches. And so this probably means he develops the Parkinson's disease. And without that, if he's not the passive recipient of American adulation in the late 80s and 90s, if he's still as fiery and, to be frank, has all his wits about him and was able to communicate as quickly and maybe you could say glibly as he was early, do we think of Ali today how we think of him? I think it changes everything. And that's why I think it's the perfect kind of what if chapter, because it hits on sports and society and really convinces you that but for that one small change, so many things would be different.
Yeah, and Lee Motvill makes the case that had he not been out of the scene for 3.5 years and he had simply boxed, just continued to box, at that point, right before he left, he had sort of beaten everybody there was to beat, and he could have very easily become, if he just kept boxing for a few more years, I probably still would have won a bunch of matches, but he probably would have been just a sort of afterthought, you know, as a 1970s boxer instead of the icon that had become really, really
great,
fascinating.
Great. He's in the Boxing Hall of Fame, but he's not, you know, Time Man of the Year.
Yeah. Let's take a phone call from a hockey fan. Mark in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Mike Pesca.
Hi there, Mike and Tom. I think I may have misunderstood what was said, but I wanted to clear something up about Wayne Gretzky's career. He started out in the World Hockey Association, not the American Hockey League. The WHA was a startup competitor to the NHL at the time and had attracted a lot of the big stars from the NHL. Gretzky started out at a tender age, 18, in Indianapolis, playing for the Indianapolis Racers. And then I'd like to also submit that, for me, one of the moments in sports, one of the greatest moments, of course, is in 1980 when the USA Olympic team won gold. You may recall that in the second period, the tempestuous Russian coach pulled the goaltender, Tretiak, arguably the best goaltender to ever play the game. Tretiak was pulled in kind of a fit of anger by the coach, and many believe that that was premature. I am one of them, and I think that the rest of the way in that game would have been far more difficult for the American team had Tretiak been allowed to remain in the game.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for the call, Mark. And I, Mike, I'm not at all in a position to adjudicate whether or not it was the World Hockey.
No, I got it wrong. He is correct. It was the WHA, and he played on Indianapolis. This is true. And I was thinking of the pulling of the goalie in the USSR game, the Miracle on Ice. But also, there was, if I were to pick an inflection point, there was a last-second goal. Literally, the United States scored at the end of, I think, the second period in the last second. And so that could be another point that we point to and say, all right, let's just, change it 1 second more.
There are a few chapters about football, one of which Nate Jackson writes a chapter called What If Football Were Reinvented Today? There's an awful lot of people who think football needs to be reinvented. So it's a sort of timely and topical proposal. And he's got some interesting proposals for rule changes. One is to have a 20-second play clock. To speed up the game, to have 30 seconds after a first down and a minute after a score, and to have offensive players lining up anywhere they want along the line of scrimmage, and not have tackles and guards have to be designated as one thing and tight ends designated another thing, and certain people designated as runners or even quarterbacks. And he's saying if we open it up like this, two things would happen. It might be more exciting, and number two, there might be fewer injuries.
Right. So Nate Jackson, former Bronco, has written a couple books, and for the New York Times, he wrote an op-ed endorsing two-way players, which the reason that he said that is it would cut down on injuries because it would make a certain kind of player obsolete, like the 340-pound lineman. You just couldn't do that if you were playing two ways. His entire chapter is an acknowledgement that if football were reinvented today, we'd know more about brain injury. But also, as popular as football is, if you look at the other sports, they have evolved and they have embraced athleticism, especially basketball, the constantly evolving sport. And there are all these players like Porzingis or Tatum who are multifaceted and can play all over the court, and that's exciting. Whereas in football, we're locked into the 340-pound guy plays one position and the receiver plays another. But as he notes, these are all great athletes. What if a bunch of them could throw the ball? What if we eliminated the pocket, which is to eliminate, you know, the Praetorian guard for the quarterback? You'd be just ratcheting, taking down the temperature a little bit and making it so that injuries naturally stopped being a huge part of the game. He wanted to, you know, the rules he set up for himself were, we'll still have four downs, a touchdown will still be worth 6 points, it'll still be 10 yards for a first down, but we're just going to change the nature of the game in terms of that there is one quarterback, he's the one guy who throws the ball, there are five guys that block for him so he could throw the ball, and that really changes everything. It's a good thought exercise. If it's not an exact, if you say, okay, I'm not going to found my own league based on those rules, it is definitely food for thought.
Yeah, I mean, there's this rule in professional football, for folks who don't follow it really closely, about ineligible men downfield. There are certain people that can't leave the area that currently protects the quarterback. What if anybody could go downfield? What if anybody could throw? Anybody could run? I think it would open it up and be really exciting. You'd have no idea what was going to happen on every play. Right now, you have it's pretty predictable. I mean, if it's third and one, they're not going to throw a 40-yard pass. You know, you have a general sense of what's happening. I think it'd be a lot more exciting. Mike Pesca, the new book is called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. Mike, we have an email from Dwight who says, what if Arnold Schwarzenegger didn't win Mr. Universe?
You mean Ferrigno? We're going to give it to Ferrigno? And then we'd have to watch Ferrigno.
Then he'd be the governor of California?
Yeah, then Lou Ferrigno is the kindergarten cop? Come on. It's not a tumor. That has to be Schwarzenegger. It only works for Schwarzenegger.
I don't know.
Schwarzenegger.
You're selling Lou Ferrigno a little short here. I think
he was,
kindergarten
he was a
cop.
He was a fine Hulk. Yeah.
He was a fine, fine Hulk. And from there to the kindergarten classroom, it's not that much of a leap. I mean, it really is.
That's right.
All right, we're going to take a little break.
Hulks.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back in just a sec. Mike Pesca, the book is called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. We'll have more sports and alternative facts with Mike Pesca. 410-662-8780 midday at WIPR.org. That's our email address, our Twitter handle at midday WIPR. Stay with us.
Something magic happens every time you go. You make the magic happen. The magic of Orioles baseball when the game
is yes. Not a whole lot of magic going on at Camden Yards or anywhere that the Orioles are on the road. However, let the record show that they did beat New York last night, the Yankees, 6-5. They have just not been beating very many other people very regularly. If you've just joined us, my guest is Mike Pesca, the host of Slate.com's daily podcast, The Gist, and the author of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us here on Midday. I have called this book A Confection of Counterfactualization, and I'm sticking to it. It's a compilation of more than 30 essays that imagine what might have happened if things had worked out differently in certain sports, both major and minor, and how particular careers and even entire industries might have been changed. If you'd like to join our conversation with Mike Pesca, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle is at midday WIPR. So, Mike, I don't know if you're hip to this news, but the BBC is reporting that Kevin Anderson from South Africa has come back from two sets down to beat Roger Federer at Wimbledon. Federer is out of the tournament this year. So what if Roger Federer went on to have a shot at yet another Grand Slam final? Ain't going to happen this year.
I would say, what if Roger Federer stuck with Nike? He's now Uniqlo and he's 0-1 while getting that endorsement. That's got to be the big thing.
Clear also, linkage.
What if the Orioles only played the Yankees this year? They'd have a winning record.
That's
you
true.
Wouldn't think it would be. Somehow they've got the Yankees numbers.
Now
it's all Danny Valencia.
Well, one of the things you write about, one of the chapters is about baseball and about what if baseball players, the Major League only had one game, where each team only had one game a week, the way football mm-hmm. does, because mm-hmm. now they just play so darn much, it really would change sort of everything, wouldn't it?
It's so fundamental because when we think, okay, what is this game? What is this sport? Define it for me. I could spend, 10 pages defining the game of baseball, explaining the game of baseball. It would probably never come up, and it's played every day. The same with football, and I would maybe not say, and it can only be played once a week. But that change, which isn't in the rules and doesn't have to be, but that one change would affect so much of the game. Will Leach, who wrote the chapter, and I were talking about it, and it started from both of our shared obsession with pitchers hitting. And so we tried to tweak the rules a little bit, and then I came up with this idea of once-a-week baseball, and he ran with it. So some of the things that would change are you would only need really one ace and a couple of good relievers on a team. And so you might be thinking it's very hard to get out of our current mindset about baseball. You might think, well, then it's not baseball, and then you're firing four pitchers who, two or three of them might be pretty good. Okay, not on the Orioles staff. But, in general, two or three of these other decent pitchers.
Rough but true, Mike. Rough but true. Yes.
Take the sport of football. We say there are only like 12 good quarterbacks, but if football were the kind of game like baseball and you would have a different quarterback once every five games, there'd be 150 quarterbacks in the league. Our entire notion of what it means to be a quarterback would be different, just like our entire notion of what it means to be a pitcher would be different. The game of baseball is all the things that it is and the DH and artificial turf and new rules about automatic walks on intentional bases on balls. One day a week changes, I would say, a third of what we know about baseball.
And I guess it's a financial thing, right? They play 160 games because they can charge admission to 160 games and sell commercials for 160 games for each team.
Well, yeah, I think it's sure. Any enterprise that's an entertainment, why not? Just like in Broadway, you do
milk
eight
it.
Shows a week if you can, right?
Yeah.
The other sports need a little more recovery time. And this is, this is my theory. The reason that football is so popular in the United States is that it's brutal. And when I say that, people say, oh, yes, people love hard hits and brutality. But that's not what I mean. What I mean is it's so brutal, you can't play it more than once a week. And therefore, it's forced scarcity. And if you know anything about supply and demand, the scarcity drives attention. And Leach is talking about this in his chapter a little bit. He's like, if baseball were played once a week, you'd tailgate before baseball games. There'd be a week's long worth of talk before baseball games. And I think the specialness of the football game, that it only takes place once a week, really drives and propels it. Whereas the baseball game, which is more pastoral and, spools out over the course of 6 months, and especially if you're team, like your team, the Orioles, and my team, the Mets, are out of it, becomes so much less exciting. And whereas with a football team, it might take half the season before you find out your team stinks.
Yeah, and sometimes you go to a game and it seems like the games themselves are spooling out over 6 months. I mean, the pace and the rhythm is, the tempo is very, very slow. There's also a chapter about what if the National League had a designated hitter. The American League adopted that back in 1973, a million years ago. Everybody talks about this all the time. Is it possible that Major League Baseball would in fact change this rule? I mean, it's certainly not the first time it's been suggested.
Yeah, it's been talked about, and the National League is the only one that has this rule in the world. I think there's it's the only one where the only highest professional league where the pitchers hit. I think it is so tied up with the identity of baseball that the National League pitchers hit that it's going to be hard to change. And it's one of many rules are held on to because that's just the way it is and that's tradition. But people, if you separated it, people really don't like tradition. I think the National League with the pitcher hitting is one of those rules where people do like tradition. On the other hand, really odd to have a professional league where half the teams play by one rule and half the teams don't. And then with all the interleague play, every day there's a game or two with mixed up rules where National League teams are using the DH, or American leagues are using the having their pitchers hit. I don't know. I'd like, personally, and the chapter is not really about that. It's about what would happen if the National League had the DH, and which teams, you know, he makes a good case. Rob Nyer makes a good case that totally different teams would have won the World Series. I mean, that's, World Series aren't won by, you know, usually teams don't crush the opposition. You just change a very important part. You change the entire outcome of a season. But I kind of like the rule as it is. And maybe that's one of the few things where I stand on tradition and I say, you know, to heck with everyone else.
Byron sends us an email, says, what if Monica Seles hadn't been stabbed in 1993? She was stabbed at a tennis match in Germany, and at the time she was number one in the world. Clearly, I mean, it would have been much better for Miss Seles, and perhaps a very, very different complexion of the women's game for quite a long time.
Yes, although pretty soon thereafter, the Williams sisters came on the scene, and I think that they were unstoppable.
Yep, and Serena certainly seems unstoppable in this particular fortnight.
We have one constant in sports, don't we? It's Serena Williams. Dominant. Federer can go, a Djokovic, or Nadal. They find every other woman, every other, all 10, the top 10 women are out only because they gave Serena the 25th ranking.
Yeah, exactly. One of the points that's made in the baseball essay, or one of the baseball essays, is that if they played once a week, that probably would not have led to the great use of performance enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball, because maybe people wouldn't need it to be able to. I mean, the season is just so grueling, you know. It's tough for some of these athletes to think about doing it any other way. Joey writes, "What if in some crazy world we allowed any and all kinds of performance enhancing drugs to be used in all sports, or to narrow it just in baseball? Does it become uninteresting, and does the playing field re-level itself if everybody is doping?" I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, can decide for themselves whether they want to take that kind of risk to their health.
Well, Ben Lindberg does write the chapter, what if they had tested for drugs? So it's the inverse of that hypothetical. What if they had tested for drugs, effectively tested for drugs, going back, you know, 20 years? And he makes, this is the charts and graphs chapter, because in addition to different tones and styles, I wanted a couple chapters to really appeal to the empirically based stats guy. And Lindberg delivers by kind of proving that we would have had a whole different landscape had there been testing. I do think, though, that had you allowed just rampant doping in baseball, you'd have a lot of records falling. You'd have a lot of eyebrows being raised. And one of the things that we like about baseball is that you can compare Honus Wagner to Danny Valencia. Wagner comes out better, but it is the 100-year history of baseball, and once there's this like huge break with the past in terms of performance-enhancing drugs, meaning steroids, meaning drugs that give you power, I think it changes things too much.
Yeah.
The greenies and the amphetamines, that's another story. That's probably been part of the sport for a long time.
Yeah, that's a lot of asterisks in the record books. Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania, welcome to the show. I know you call us frequently. We're glad to hear from you. Thanks for your call.
Yes, I want to know what would have happened if Jim Thorpe's life had went another way and if Satchel Paige would have been introduced into the major leagues. And I can't think of the coach's name, but he was the coach of Notre Dame when they had the Four Horsemen.
The Newt Rockne?
Newt Rockne. What would have happened if these three people would have had a change in the system?
Yeah, that's an interesting speculation. Satchel Paige going to the majors before Jackie Robinson, because it wasn't just Jackie Robinson's baseball acumen; it was his incredible, you know, personal fortitude to survive that ordeal.
Yeah, the idea of taking all these great Negro leaguers, your Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell, and trying to inject them into the major league seasons that were going on. This is actually something that baseball researchers do, and this is something that sabermetricians have tried to do. And it's fascinating to read what their project projected statistics would be. It shouldn't surprise you that, you know, Cool Papa Bell would have led the league in stolen bases. I mean, these were great, great players, especially by the fact that when black players started to be introduced in the major leagues, because it was so hard and you had to just pick the best black players, they dominated, right? They dominated for many, many years. And then, unfortunately, I think that there's been a fall off in the interest of the African-American playing baseball. But yeah, it's a great question.
Thanks for that call, Clarence. You write about, one of the writers writes about Title IX. What if it had never been, you know, would have never been implemented in 1972? That's when it came in. During that year, 294,000 girls participated in high school sports. 3.7 million boys did. And of course, that allotment has changed dramatically.
Yeah, and that chapter dovetails with our Billie Jean King chapter and our What If the U.S. Women's Soccer Team in 1999 Had Not Won the World Cup. And what those chapters to me show is that you can change history and take one thing out, but also kind of prove that, you know, history has this way of marching on and not being denied. So Billie Jean King, the author of that chapter, Wayne Coffey, pretty much convinces us that, you know, had she lost to Bobby Riggs, and we could tell that she was the better player and was mentally tough enough to win, and also had the better game plan. So give her a hamstring injury, something that, you know, causes her to lose. I am convinced there's no denying that she comes back and beats Bobby Riggs. Somehow she asserts herself, right? So even though we're doing hypotheticals, it's also important to say that there are some instances that have a hard way of being denied, you know? But the Title IX chapter and the Women's World Cup chapter, I think the point of that chapter is, even though these earth-shattering things happened, how much did they really change? And without giving away too much of the Women's World Cup chapter, and in our podcast, the Upon Further Review podcast, the writer of that chapter tells the story in audio form. And then the moment Brandi Chastain takes the kick, she misses. And the whole report plays out as if this is what would have happened had she missed. And we have the actual, we have Brandi Chastain, we have Julie Foudy, we have the actual players. They're not actually playing along, but you think they're playing along with this. It's fascinating because actually the point is not much would have changed. Women's sports are still so much behind men's sports, even with these earth-shaking, earth-shattering developments, and even with the force of Title IX. That's definitely something to ponder and think about.
It's a terrific book, Mike. Before we leave, we just got a little time left. Care to make a prediction about the World Cup? England is playing Croatia in about an hour. The winner of that match meets France in the final on Sunday. What do you think?
I think France will win. I don't know who they'll play. I want France to play England because, you know, the Hundred Years' War still needs to be relitigated. But I think France just looks really good on both ends of the pitch.
How about Trump and NATO? Who wins that one?
I would say NATO on penalty kicks. Trump might get the red card and be sent off.
That's right. He might indeed draw a red card. Lord knows what else he might draw. The book is called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History by Mike Pesca. He's the host of the daily podcast The Gist on Slate.com and a commentator on Here and Now. Among many other duties, there is also a podcast called Upon Further Review. Mike, thanks so much. It's good to talk to you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, it's another installment of Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday. And, of course, the film critic for The Washington Post, Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. Plus, J. Wynn Russick, our theater reviewer, will be here with her thoughts on the Contemporary Theater Festival over in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Lunch for our guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. I'm sure we can ship them to Brooklyn, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. We've got more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming up right after the NPR News at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.